Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 192, recorded 23rd of November, 2011. Open Rights Group. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring available sync with MyFord Touch. Sync with MyFord Touch gets you to your destination with integrated turn-by-turn directions and directional arrows displayed on screen. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at ford.com/technology. Hello and welcome to another Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. As you may be able to tell, I'm not your regular host, Randall Schwartz. It's another British takeover, as I'm joined by Simon Fripps, who's in London. Simon, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you, Dan. I'm here at the offices of the Open Rights Group in London, where I've come out and captured our guest, Jim Killick, who I'll bring on in a moment.
Excellent. Sounds good. And before we talk about the guest, we should mention that Randall's not here this week because it's his 50th birthday. So we've got to give him a massive congratulations from everyone at Floss Weekly, obviously, and I hope he's having a great time celebrating his birthday. Yeah, there we go. So we'll see him next week and he can tell us all about it. Okay, so on to the guest. As you mentioned, we've got Jim Killick, who is the executive director.
I survived being 50, I'm sure he can.
Excellent. I haven't quite reached it yet, but I'm hoping to survive being 50. That would be nice. We've got Jim Killick coming on today, who is the executive director of the Open Rights Group. And the Open Rights Group is a lobby group based in London who are fighting for digital rights, essentially fighting against things like censorship, copyright, censorship on the internet, all these kind of onerous copyright laws that are coming up now. They do lots of work with many of the politicians and so on. And this is a very bad intro, but I'm sure Jim will be able to give us a better rundown of that. So this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring Sync with the MyFord Touch. Sync is an in-car communications, entertainment and connectivity system that's voice activated to help you keep your hands on the wheel and keep your eyes on the road. One of the great features of Sync is Sync services. Sync services give you audible turn-by-turn directions to where you want to go, displays directional arrows on screen, all without having to purchase an aftermarket or integrated navigation system. It's all in there. Sync services also include business search for over 40 million businesses, including telephone numbers, business information, and directions. A send to sync feature, which enables you to use Google Maps or MapQuest or something similar to plan your trip and then sync it over to the navigation system in the car. And then you can use voice commands in your vehicle to get turn-by-turn directions. A free Sync Destinations app, which is available in the app stores, is also out there. And it gives you mobile access to your Sync traffic directions and information systems account. The ability to pre-save destinations to your account, such as your home or your office. So go and check out Ford Sync, Ford with Sync and My Ford Touch right now. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Jim Killick of the Open Rights Group. Jim, can you hear us?
Absolutely. How are you?
I'm great. And this is the part of the show where Randall usually asks the guest where they're calling from. But in this case, it seems a little bit redundant because you're actually in the same location as Simon. I saw him on the back of your webcam before. So you're both in London at the Open Rights Group office. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. There's us and our staff and Simon, who's just joining Org's board, all in the same office right now.
Wow. Excellent. Now, I started off by giving a little brief overview of the Open Rights Group, but obviously, I'm sure you can give us a much better kind of rundown of what the Open Rights Group is and how it got started.
So we started in 2005 when around about 1,000 digital activists in the UK thought, you know, the UK really needs something like the EFF to defend digital rights in the UK. There were plenty of threats at the time, from things like ID cards through to potential surveillance on the internet and the usual slightly crazy copyright concerns. And basically people in the UK wanted somebody to fight these things and just sort of establish that the human rights do apply to the digital age. This isn't some sort of free-for-all where governments or corporations or you know, absurd laws, whatever it is, can just sort of erode those rights and leave us actually surveilled with no rights to free speech, or potentially. You know, that's really what was needed, and that's what we've tried to do since. We've grown from having around sort of 700 or 800 people subscribing and one or two members of staff to now five members of staff fighting on many more fronts. So we're doing a lot of work still on copyright, a lot of work on privacy. And in the UK now, we suddenly have to find ourselves really defending free speech rights. We have a plethora of censorship proposals in the UK at the moment. So we're really actively trying to stop both copyright censorship and things like hate speech censorship, and even government trying to sort of sneak in means of censoring extremist websites without court orders through bans across their public estate. So there's a huge number of sort of extrajudicial proposals to censor in the UK at the moment. Unlike other countries, there isn't a single proposal to sort of ban lots of things. What we have is lots and lots of little initiatives across government, which makes it that bit more difficult to fight. But we are seeing a real pattern at the moment of attacks on our ability to you know, choose what we see online, in fact.
And obviously a big part of your work is lobbying in Westminster in the UK government. So there's been, I presume, being based in London, you can kind of head there and get involved and do some kind of direct lobbying stuff as well.
That's right. So we work a lot with government officials, other interested groups, people representing ISPs, or even talking to people in the music and copyright industries and getting them to try to rethink a little bit. But most of it concentrates on, yes, working with MPs, working with government officials and people like Ofcom, just to say, you know, what do you actually know about what you're proposing here? You know, have you asked the right questions? Have you been given the right evidence? Do you understand the consequences of what's being proposed? So some of it is simply trying to educate those people, and some of this is just trying to give them better options for the things that they're trying to deal with. So that's absolutely a huge part of our work. But we also want to be working, I think, more in the legal field, so trying to help people find lawyers and get the right advice. And we also want to be doing more sort of digital activism, if you like, to sort of try to get people to use tools to protect their free speech and their privacy online. So those are sorts of things we're trying to do now, and we're trying to widen our work in that sort of way. But always the focus of it, you know, the really important and sort of consistent thing we're doing at the moment is working, yes, on government policy, on bills. And I think, you know, we're going to see in the new year a lot of new and dangerous proposals trying to be shoved into the communications bill. We'll see a green paper in the spring, and I'm fairly sure we'll see things about credit card bans for people accused of copyright infringement. We might see new censorship proposals. You know, there are just about everybody with their favourite or least favourite social ill is being encouraged to propose something to go into that. So we're going to have a lot of work over the next year, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be lots of stuff to keep you busy. One of the things that I found really interesting about the Open Rights Group was the way that it started. I know you talked about that a bit already, but it could really be described as a kind of a grassroots movement, because it came out of this proposal, and then I don't know, I think it was 1,000 people who were looking forward to pledge £5 per month to fund the formation of the group. So it really feels like a kind of a grassroots thing. I should point out, I am one of the people who signed the pledge and pays the the £5 a month. So I am an org supporter. Yeah, do you consider it like a grassroots kind of thing as well?
Yeah, and we make a lot of effort to get the community to help, you know, by contacting their MPs, by you know, participating in meetings, by telling their friends about the issues. You know, it certainly is a grassroots movement. You know, still over half of that, or around about half of the money that we have to spend, it comes directly from individuals. And I think that gives us a great deal of power and credibility, as well as as well as demonstrating that people power works.
So I'm quite interested to get some more details from you, Jim. You know, I've signed up to be on your board of directors, Could you tell me something about the governance of this organization? You know, is it who runs it? Who gets to call the shots?
Well, ultimately, you do. The board of directors. So, you know, it's all your fault now, Simon. the board of directors is responsible for the governance and make sure that we're well run, that we are expanding and trying to have more capacity and being able to influence policy more. And we have an extremely strong advisory council as well, which helps us form policy, work out what the really concerning things are and what we need to be dealing with. And that includes all kinds of experts, many of whom would be very familiar to Floss Weekly viewers. I mean, people like Alan Cox, who's been involved in development of Linux kernel, through to people like Cory Doctorow, sci-fi author and journalist, and many people, other people that you might know, people like Danny O'Brien, who worked for many years at EFF and currently works on free speech issues. So, you know, there's a big range of people there who are really telling us about what to be looking out for over the next sort of 2 to 5 or 10 years even, and what we should be really trying to make sure government knows and understands, and exactly how it is that we defend our rights, if you like, and what it is that we need to ask for. We also have a team of legal advisors at Org Law who do similar work, and occasionally we also refer individuals who've got sort of digital rights issues, copyright concerns, privacy issues, defamation, and so on. So it's, we sort of pass on people to our legal volunteers. On occasion, you know, when people are affected very, very directly. So there's all of that. And then we also have, as I mentioned, a team of staff who are working on these issues day to day as well.
So I see you do have a charming staff. The viewers can't actually see them around us, but they're all very politely trying to ignore the conversation that we're having with each other through a studio in California. Do you want to just say a little bit about your staff? Try not to embarrass them too much.
Yeah, so... where Simon is sat normally working Javier Ruiz, who works on open data. He's not here today because he's just become a dad. And he's been campaigning to sort of make sure that the government does the right thing with open data and actually gives us information, the sort of core information like maps and weather data, so that we can analyze and understand the rest of what government does using that core information. Peter Bradwell, who's sat to my left, works full-time on copyright issues and free speech concerns, the censorship campaigns, and is really building an expertise around exactly what we need to change in copyright law, and is pushing for things like parody exceptions, pushing against the Digital Economy Act implementation, and working on the sort of plethora of censorship proposals that we're currently seeing. I've been working on some of those sort of censorship issues as well, but also on things like Nominet's domain suspension proposals. In the UK at the moment, Nominet is considering, or is in fact on a monthly basis, taking police requests to suspend domain names, and has currently no procedure to deal with that, let alone insisting on court orders. So I've been working on that, and also on the Data Protection Directive and some of those big privacy issues in Europe. So you know, that's sort of a broad range of what we do. Also working on things like online behavioral advertising and profiling. And we have Simon, who is working as our administrator, not Simon Phipps, but Simon to my right. And we have Nishma, who is working as our sort of community organizer and is running meetings every month in London at the moment to sort of get our community engaged and really sort of get that sort of activist base sort of doing neat things to campaign and to influence policy and just let everyone know about the issues at hand. Then we also have just hired Lee, who's in the corner, and Lee is working on sort of technical activism. So we're hoping to be doing things like helping to promote Tor in the UK and help org supporters implement Tor nodes, things like that. And again, might well be helping us with things like helping users to find their cookie information. If you want to find out about stuff, then just go to openrightsgroup.org/our work, and you'll see a link to our staff page on that page. You can sort of see some potted bios, what people have done before they came to org, and all the great things they've been responsible for down the years.
So that's a huge amount of work that you have a very small number of people working on. So do you want to tell us about some notable wins that you've had over the really, I was quite surprised how short a time Open Rights Group has existed. Oh, to look at the screen and not at you. I've been surprised by just how short a time Open Rights Group has existed. And I know that that you've had some good successes in that time. Do you want to tell us about some of them?
So I guess sort of really big things that I think we've done in the last few years. I mean, we... So in the first sort of 6 months or a year that I was here, we were running a big campaign against the company Form, who were attempting to intercept people's traffic at an ISP level. British Telecom and people like that were trying to use Form as a technology to profile their users by reading their internet traffic. And then they were going to use that profiling information to sell advertising. A pretty despicable thing to do, really. And very dangerous and certainly breaking laws. So we campaigned against that and quite successfully engaged both the European Commission and then major companies to sort of object to Form. And we pretty much, alongside other campaigners, pretty much stopped that from being commercially viable in the UK. And they left. They're busy trying to do the same thing in Asia and Brazil at the moment. So they haven't gone away, but they're certainly not working here. We didn't manage to win, but we delayed copyright term extension in Europe for a couple of years as a result of the work we did. And perhaps a bit more, you know, sort of decisively stopped e-voting from raising its head in the UK. We spent a couple of years working on that. And although there's a little bit of e-counting going on, which we'll be working on next year, we really did manage to demonstrate that getting black box computers to do election counting was a pretty dangerous proposition and was really very, very difficult to stop from being abused, and it was really more or less impossible to verify that the election results using e-voting were valid. So we managed to show that and show how expensive it was and pretty much killed that dead a couple of years back. More recently, the really big thing we've been working on has been a combination of trying to push for copyright reform, actually get things like format shifting, which is currently not legal in the UK, and pushing for things like parody and the sort of copyright flexibility we all need in the digital age. We've been pushing on that. And that we pushed at the same time as trying to attack the Digital Economy Act and the big enforcement measures. And I think we've had some success there. And the UK may well start actually implementing those sorts of flexibilities, and that will be at least in part down to our work. Equally importantly, I think we have really managed to damage the Digital Economy Act's reputation. Now, we haven't stopped the Digital Economy Act. You don't always get everything you want. But what we have done is demonstrate that it is sheer madness, that it is going to cause more trouble than it possibly could be worth, that people are going to object to it from start to finish. And we've also managed in that to show exactly how bad the evidence was and how manipulated politicians have been over this. A week or two ago, I was speaking to a parliamentary committee and I was using some evidence that Peter, I was mentioning, I'm working on copyright, sort of exposed, you know, exactly how bad their analysis had been. And as it goes, the Digital Economy Act was based around the idea that £400 million worth of damage was being done to copyright industries. And we showed that even that figure has never been analysed, even by government. We didn't know this at the time. We knew that the methodologies had been kept secret from the public, but we assumed they had at least shown them to government. That appears not to be the case. So the government wasn't shown these analyses either. So basically, government just took this entirely on trust, on the trust of the people with who wanted the policy and had the most to benefit. I mean, you'd think that was pretty unwise, but that is exactly what happened. And now we have that admitted by government officials who said, you know, apologized for this and said that they were just having to, make bricks with the best available straw. So there we have it, straw bricks for a digital world. That is government.
That's
a straw, yeah. I mean, just incredible admission, really. But yeah, that was down to us, really. We managed to expose that, and we've, I think, again, had a bit of a victory there. I mean, in just showing how badly made this policy was, and that the copyright industries are not to be trusted when it comes to the evidence that they produce.
So we've got quite a few Americans in the chat room who are asking questions about US laws over there. I know that one of the campaigns that you're working on at the moment involves domain suspensions. Mm. Do you have any views about why we're seeing these domain suspension laws showing up in the US at the moment, and why suddenly it seems to become a topic in all of the different venues that you watch around the world? What is it? Is it something in the air or something in the water that makes legislators in every country suddenly decide that they're interested in domain suspension all at the same time? What's going on there, Jim?
I think you've answered your own question. I mean, the truth of it is that copyright lobbyists particularly are great at getting a good idea or a very bad idea and then pushing it simultaneously in every possible avenue that they can. Now, I'm not saying, you know, there are other people who are also noticing the idea of domain suspensions, but, you know, generally when you see an idea pop up in a number of places, you can bet that basically, there are a bunch of people who are meeting, discussing this internationally and say, hey, it wouldn't be a great idea if we did this. And there you have it. It's been pushed. The same with three strikes laws. You know, three strikes laws aren't some sort of natural phenomenon is just obvious to any government once it starts thinking about it. No, it's something that's being pushed as a sort of moral crusade against internet users by copyright owners, a way of actually redefining the debate as being about theft rather than about their businesses. And I think the same is the case with domain suspensions. What's going on in Nominet, I would add that in the UK, there's a slight other dimension here. We've basically, you know, got very, very lazy law enforcement. And, you know, they've worked something out. They've had a bright idea, right? They've just thought, you know what? We don't need to go to all these hosts. We don't need to find out who's registering these domains or work out what we really need to do to remove this material. They just think, well, it's a domain and the domains are controlled by Nominet. So why don't we just go there? We can do that and it'll be really easy. We can just give them a list of things to suspend, list of domains to suspend. And instead of having to contact several dozen hosts, they just need to ask Nominet, who, of course, have got no clue about this material at all, have no relationship with the people who own the domains at all. But nevertheless, they can do this job of just flicking a switch and switching it off. So I think it's a combination of some people pushing very hard internationally with a particular agenda, and in the UK, some people picking up these ideas and being essentially extremely lazy.
So does that mean that it's a really good idea for you to keep an eye on what's happening in other jurisdictions? Because presumably over here in the UK, we can expect to see really bad law like SOPA or IP Protect showing up in our legislature fairly soon, because we've already seen that that's the tactic that the pro-control lobby is having in the US. Is that what you do to cheat?
Well, I'm not sure if watching sort of disgusting lobbying being promoted, you know, promoted everywhere else is quite cheating. But I mean, I think in a way they're cheating by just trying to find the weakest links. You know, what they do is they find a government that's got no clue, or one that's highly susceptible to listening to their rights holders, like France. You know, perhaps the South Korean government had less of an idea about the balances to be struck and were easy to be knocked because of trade considerations. Perhaps France was a good one because it's in a, you know, Sarkozy and French governments tend to be in the pockets of rights holders, and perhaps the UK's in the same boat. And then the harder governments, like, say, Germany, who've got a strong human rights record, or the Netherlands, who are both liberal and pro user rights, you know, they don't go for them. They go for people like us. And then once they've built that momentum, then they go back to the States and say, look, you know what, all these governments have been doing these dreadful things, and now it's your turn, you've got to do them, because we're falling behind and our competitiveness is being eroded because, you know, other people have got better enforcement. You know, that's the sort of arguments they'll be making. So, yeah, absolutely, we have to cooperate with EFF and groups like La Quadrature and Dunette in France, groups like EDRI, who represent some all of our groups in Europe. Yeah, we have to work with these with all of these groups because, we're all suffering the same threats. We're all being threatened in exactly the same way. And, you know, we pretty much know if once these policies raise in one place, they will be very quickly being pushed elsewhere. They have a real machine, the rights holders. You know, I mean, they're pretty disgusting in many ways. I mean, I hope that's not too impolitic to say, but I mean, I often feel a lot of what they say is really close to lying. I mean, for instance, at the moment, We've got sites being blocked. We've got Newsbin being blocked by British Telecom and other people trying to block this site. Now, Newsbin.com is not a particularly legitimate site. It's clearly infringing copyright, or at least encouraging people to infringe copyright by downloading binary files from forums. But how you deal with that? I mean, actually, I suspect that site's pretty easy to remove. I say that because they're receiving payments. Those payments are going through a company. That company is registered in the UK, and there is a public list of directors with that company in the UK. Now, I'm not an investigative journalist or a policeman or a copyright enforcement agency, but I think that would be a fairly good way to start, to start looking at those questions. And, you know, I think it would probably also be cheaper to do that. But that's not interesting to the copyright owners. They're not actually, I think, I don't know, but it strikes me that they are probably not interested in actually removing copyright infringing sites. What they're interested in the case of Newsbin is getting website blocking. So they're using it to push for website blocking, which is complicated, expensive, is going to involve them getting court orders or otherwise compelling blocking over every single network in the UK. And if they want it blocked elsewhere, then every single ISP or network in the world. Now, that doesn't seem to me like a simple proposition, especially not compared to working out who it is exactly who's running Newsbin and then taking them to court. But that's a strategy that they're pushing, and that tells me that they're not being entirely honest.
Mm. I went to ask you a little bit about the mechanics of this kind of blocking of sites, because you mentioned about Nominet and so on. But the big thing that keeps kind of popping up in my mind is the whole WikiLeaks thing. I mean, they tried for a very long time to take WikiLeaks down. And we saw people walking around with IP addresses on T-shirts and so on. So if Nominet were to take out the DNS and so on, you could still use the IP. And then, of course, as you say, they would try and block the connections and so on. Isn't this ultimately kind of futile? Because as we've seen with WikiLeaks, that if people want to mirror these things and keep them going, it's really difficult for central government to kind of stamp down on them. And it seems that's what they're scared of right now.
It depends what the result you want is. I think with WikiLeaks, they weren't interested in restricting that material. It was embarrassing, but it was already out there and it was already in the hands of loads and loads of journalists. I think we also have to conclude that if it was that easy for WikiLeaks to get the material, then probably several governments had already got large parts of it as well. I mean, if you have a million people with that level of access and it eventually leaks out to the public, then it's probably leaked several times to other people. You know, just my guess, but I mean, that would be What I think they wanted to do with WikiLeaks was to shut it down financially, and to stop it from being in any way a powerful organization. So they couldn't take it to court, and they never have taken it to court. What they did in leaking that material was probably not illegal in the United States. Leaking it itself, that's to say the person who took the material from the United States government systems and gave it to WikiLeaks, that person probably has broken the law. But the person doing the publishing in the United States is generally not thought to be breaking the law doing that. So, different jurisdictions have different attitudes to this, but that is pretty much how the US has viewed it. So if in that case, you're not interested in taking WikiLeaks to court or showing that they're a dangerous or bad organization. What you're interested in doing is removing their power. So what they did was to attack their ability to fund themselves and to, the domain thing was another thing that they attacked, probably through private measures. But I mean, to my mind, what happened there was just sheer lawlessness, and not from WikiLeaks, but from the government. The government decided to behave like some sort of Wild West corrupt sheriff and just go around compelling people to do stuff without any sort of court involvement. Basically bullied credit card companies into pulling the plug. That's unacceptable behavior.
I like the comparison to kind of martial law there. It does seem quite apt. So people in the IRC are asking, some of the American viewers and listeners are asking what Nominet is, because they're not really sure. So it's the domain name registrar. Is that a good description, do you think?
That's right. So, well, it's the registry. So it's the .uk sort of registry. So they then allow people to resell .co.uk or .org.uk domains, and they decide what UK domains are going to look like. So they're sort of a public interest company. They're the UK organization delegated from ICANN, if you like, to do this work. And they're sort of private, but they're basically run by the registrars. So the people who are actually doing the reselling have a big stake in the organization. But it's always tried to work in the public interest and presented itself as sort of a trusted organization for the UK. And it's a not-for-profit organization as well. So it should have very good attitudes. Personally, I have found it really quite strange as to why they've ended up behaving as they have done here. I mean, at least every 12 months, but for the last two or three years, they've suspended a couple of thousand domains for counterfeiting, selling counterfeit goods on .co.uk domains. Now, I'm not saying that's legitimate, and clearly the vast majority of that has not been legitimate, but the procedure's been pretty shocking. I mean, the people whose domains have been suspended, if they were told that if they had a problem, that they could go to the police and the police would re-examine what they'd done. They did get a handful of complaints and around about a dozen, and some of those were then reinstated. So, we don't really know what's happened, where people have just thought, well, the police are not going to give me a fair hearing, or and then just sort of given up. We just don't know who those people might be. And in any case, I mean, the idea that the police can simply compel Nominet, or that Nominet will simply roll over and do what they're asked, and then if there's a problem, that the same police will then decide whether they were right or not, I mean, that is not acceptable. Now, Nominet, to be fair, have realized that was not acceptable, and then have tried to find a policy to deal with that. But the problem has been that the police won't accept a system that involves court orders, because they don't believe that they've got the time or the resources to get court orders. And therefore, we've all been trying to sort of struggle to find some way of doing this that actually respects people's rights. And in the end, we've had to conclude that it isn't possible. So we'll see what happens next. It'll be very interesting.
Right, okay. And one of the big things that I hear a lot in relation to this, and people are actually talking about it in the IRC channel right now, is alternatives to the internet, which I find quite interesting. But you've already mentioned Tor, the onion router that people have talked about. So they're effectively seem to be talking about dark nets and things like that. Is that a realistic option, do you think?
Well, I think it is for some people in some circumstances. I mean, Tor, for instance, has .onion, doesn't it? So if you want to run a website and you want to publish it and you want it to be entirely anonymous, you can, and you can do that on Tor. But obviously that's only available to those few people who are on the Tor network and are, you know, also prepared to do things in that way, which might be relatively slow compared to the sort of open internet, if you like. So... Mm-hmm. Not I'm saying that Tor isn't open exactly, but you see what I mean. They're sort of normal internet. Mm. So yeah, I mean, if you want to do things in that way, then I think it's going to be increasingly possible. I think the question is, in a way, whether that's entirely good. And I mean, personally, I think it's fine where it needs to happen. You know, Tor is necessary for people who are suffering censorship. It's an absolute necessity that people evade that and can organise and get the information that they need. And so Tor's doing an incredibly vital job. But if you're trying to think, you know, in a sort of wider public policy sort of way, if you're thinking, well, you know, what I really need is a darknet in order to download... you know, MP3s or dodgy copies of movies or whatever. Now, mm-hmm. well, you know, I don't think that's especially good from a public policy point of view. You know, that what should be happening is that we should be helping customers to find ways of buying legal material in a way that works for them, as opposed to sort of not supplying that material and giving everybody. A really good reason to, you know, sort of go set up darknets purely for copyright infringement, no, more or at least largely. You know, I suppose the thing that's suffering here is copyright. In each case, whenever we get these sort of censorship proposals, whether it's copyright, whether it's terrorism, whatever it happens to be, what censorship does is legitimize whatever the activity that's being censored is. So if you censor extreme sites, that says that stuff's dangerous. These people are a bit cool. They are certainly posing a very strong threat to government because they're having to resort to censorship. And if they don't want you to hear it, there must be some truth in it. That's the implication. So it legitimizes that behavior. So it's a complete own goal to censor in that case. And I think it's exactly the same with copyright. You know, copyright is you know, generally a legitimate thing. It's a way of people deciding how to get remunerated and to, you know, benefit from their work. But if the only way that you can enforce copyright is by censorship, then a lot of people will conclude that the problem is the copyright owners and that they have a complete right to evade that censorship and do what they like. And that, again, is a no goal. You know, it's something that shouldn't happen because we should be trying to get copyright to work, not proving to people that it's impossible to do without removing their civil liberties.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a complicated issue. It makes me think back to FOSDEM earlier in the year, which is a free and open source developers conference in Brussels, where actually Simon was there as well. And I watched the keynote by Evan Moglen, who's the main counsel for the Free Software Foundation. And he was advocating something he was calling the Freedom Box. I don't know how far that ever got, but he was effectively wanting to have a box that people would have in their home that would give them, you know, encrypted connections and so on. Have you heard any more about that, or have you had any kind of discussion with the FSF about those kind of things?
We haven't been in discussion with them, though. I'm hopeful that projects like this are what Lee will take on as a technical officer, you know, sort of trying to do these sort of technical activism projects. I think that's what that's a really strong demonstration, I think, is that firstly, you know, the analysis that Evan Moglen has is really powerful. You know, it's about you controlling your information, you controlling your privacy, you controlling how you share your information. So, and they, you know, in a way that the Freedom Box is saying that you want to do this in quite a physical way. You know, it's not just about the laws and the rights. There's also a sort of physicality to how you might express and defend your rights. I think that's really, really powerful, very, very interesting. And it sort of echoes, has a lot of echoes with the sort of free software movement in general, you know, saying essentially what you need is to be able to control and do what you need to do and what you would like to do with the information that you are using, you know, the software itself. So I think that's incredibly interesting. Where it'll go, I mean, who knows? I mean, actually, Tor are about to do a very similar thing, actually, with not quite a Freedom Box, but with sort of home disk type device by Excito, a Swedish company, and it's going to come pre-installed with a Tor node or Tor software. So the idea is that home users will be able to get a box which allows them to sort of share files and store their digital information, and also run Tor, which I think is really, quite amazingly interesting. I think the more people that sort of get hands-on with the technology and realize that the technology actually in its own way is a way to express and defend rights, I think that's incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was quite interested to hear you talking about copyright being made to work there, Jim. Because I actually wonder whether it is possible to make copyright work. It seems to me that copyright is the expression of a society that inherently has got control points in it. And the world of the internet is a world that inherently has no control points. And I wonder whether it's actually feasible to fix copyright, or whether what we need to do is go back to first principles and invent something that does its job, but in a different way. How do you feel about that? Is it all about pragmatism and fixing what you can, or is Open Rights Group into going back to first principles and inventing the law the way it should be for the digital age?
Well, I think we have to try to go to first principles, but I think there's also a question, if the most natural fitting ways of doing business and using information in the digital age are about sharing and about lack of control, then we must give the internet and society the chance to make that choice. So in a way, if these are the best ways of doing things, then we should be able to find models, whatever the copyright laws say, to outcompete some of those sort of copyright models. Now, I the internet is only one model in society for information distribution. There's also things like television, and physical media still at the moment. I don't think we can necessarily say which model will win. I also think we have to think very carefully about what happens if you remove copyright. If you remove copyright, then there are still going to be some very, very big businesses who want to control that information, and they will find ways to do that. And they may well be more obnoxious than copyright is. So I'm not completely convinced that we can just get rid of it. I certainly think that you do have to switch to questions about remuneration rather than questions of control. I agree with that. And I also think that never in the world is copyright going to be enforced by technological measures. That just simply isn't going to happen. The technology is going in the opposite direction, and people are not interested in being controlled in that sort of way. And I think that in a way, the way that if copyright is going to work, and I agree there are some questions about its suitability, but if it is going to work, it's going to do it through consent. People are going to think this is a reasonable way for me to get the video or the music that I want, and I'm prepared to pay for it in this sort of way. And it's up to companies to do that. They need to show that and make that happen. And I personally think that they've got a reasonable chance of doing that a lot of the time. I mean, I think people are fine with paying for things. I don't think people really have a problem with that. I mean, I agree with you on a theoretical level. Copyright is not the greatest fit with information free-flowing sort of society, and we should find ways to do it better than copyright implies. But I don't necessarily think that's the same thing as saying, because it doesn't fit very well, it should be sort of immediately abolished. I think we have to find better ways of doing things.
Right. So if copyright continues to exist, though, we're going to keep on having this problem where people do steal stuff you know, it's, I know I'm not supposed to use the word steal because it isn't the same thing. But, you know, you and I and everyone on the show here understands that people are out there downloading stuff that they have no right to and shouldn't be downloading. And their act of doing so is screwing it all up for the rest of us, because it's causing the knee-jerk reaction from all of the content owners to put in place their incredibly stupid DRM measures. How do we square this circle? How do we continue to push for digital liberties and yet explain to legislators and to content owners that pushing for digital liberties doesn't mean a free license to take their revenue away from them?
Well, I think there's some growing up to be done on lots of people's behalf, but particularly with the copyright industries and government. I think, you know, I think it's incredibly telling that Microsoft have just said no to SOPA and have just said this sort of copyright enforcement, it's a bad idea. Nearly every large company in the internet space has intellectual property and copyrights. But they're not necessarily saying the only way we can deal with this is by enforcement. I think, you know, basically we need a mind shift. And I think that's sort of about saying, well, okay, there are private rights here. There's copyright. People have got some, you know, they do need some reasonable enforcement. And that is mostly about legal mechanisms. It's about going to court. It's about notice and takedown or whatever it happens to be. The problem is that you cannot get perfect copyright enforcement, especially not when there are hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people using free-flowing information technologies. At the same time, the idea that there is just so much infringement we can't possibly deal with it, this is just nonsense. I mean, it really is nonsense. To the extent that there is copyright infringement, you're seeing market signal that there's demand to be satiated and your business needs to find a way of supplying a product to them. Copyright infringement, when it takes place outside of a proper market economy. If you're running an essentially infringing site, you're hugely open to legal action, and you can't get serious investors to put money into your business. So you are, you know, ultimately an irrelevance to the really big industries. You are an irrelevance. You are never going to make serious impact on what they're doing. So for the copyright industry, they just need to be better. And they need to take legal action, targeted legal action in a private sort of way where necessary. What they cannot do, and what politicians need to grow up in a way or at least, you know, realize will change and work out, is that just because somebody has got a private right does not mean that every single piece of technology then has to fit in with enforcing that right, which is essentially what the copyright owner's argument is. It is because these things copy stuff and we have a right to stop people copying, then we must be the people giving all devices and all networks and all individuals permission to copy at the point that they might do that copying. That is essentially the logic of their argument, and that is why they're saying, we want these vetoes, we want these takedowns, we want these people cut off. What they're arguing for is control. And they're arguing for control not because they're worried about infringement, but because they want to be the people determining how the market works. And that is a very different thing. And that simply has to be exposed and understood. And once that's understood, then the argument changes. I'm not saying that's an easy thing to do, but I think that is... I think that is ultimately achievable, not least because the things that they push are so absurd and unworkable that in the end, you just cannot expect them to be implemented.
Hmm. Now, this is all really interesting to me because I am a musician. You can see the kind of guitar just over my shoulder there on the video. But I do actually make some money out of music and stuff, but I use Creative Commons. And it seems to me, I have this argument a lot with quite a lot of people. I've been to some PRS events and other things, and obviously they have a very different view on these things. And it seems to me that the business models need to adapt. Or content industries and so on need to adapt to the new world rather than trying to, you know, change the world to fit the old business model. Is that what you would say?
I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a world of distinction between what the business models look like and what the law looks like. I mean, as I say, there's a relationship, but they're not the same thing. So I think what you're saying with Creative Commons, in a way, is that you know, if you want to make money as a musician, then what's really important is relationship with your fans. It's maybe getting people to your gigs, but it's certainly persuading your fans to part with money and give that preferably directly to you rather than to Apple iTunes, who give a little bit to the PRS, who then maybe give a bit to the musician. And, you know, by the time the musician's actually in the square, you know, and getting a paycheck, it's like, you know, a couple of percent of what was originally paid. So, you know, there are some really interesting ways that musicians can make money, whether that's through sharing their music or asking people for voluntary donations or whatever. However, that is not the same thing, I think, as sort of, you know, do you change copyright to fit that? It can still remain your choice about how you choose to license your work and how you choose to relate to your fans. I just think that that doesn't suit big businesses who basically want to ring up the internet and get it to stop or license, you know. It's a bit like the sort of, you know, the problem about Europe that the Americans used to say, if I want to ring up Europe, who do I call? I think politicians in the music industry think the same way about the internet.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems that way. So, I mean, there are a lot of bodies, different kind of lobbying groups within the music industry as well. We've got UK Music, we've got a Featured Artists Coalition and all that kind of stuff. Do you kind of talk to them, and do you have any interaction with those kind of people?
Yeah, I think the Featured Artists Coalition is very interesting. I think they've brought something new to the debate. I think the smallest musicians, sort of the sort of musicians who are making money as individuals, many of whom are thriving because of the internet. Actually, I mean, people like Steve Lawson, Solar Bass Steve on Twitter. You know, his argument is that his entire business has been changed, and he can actually make a living as a musician in a way that he couldn't have done before the internet. You know, and I think that's very true for a lot of individuals and sort of small bands and so on. I think there's a sort of thriving group of people there whose voices need to be heard. PRS, UK Music, we do deal with them. Peter meets with them quite regularly. And, you know, certainly we do want to have a dialogue with those people. At the same time, we're not here to dictate to the music industry how they should do business, or tell them that their rights have all got to go away or anything like that. That really isn't our business. Our business is to say, well, copyright is something which needs to fit in a sane way with other parts of industry and the interests of society at large. And it is simply not acceptable to take copyright as the sort of most important factor when you're trying to work out how it is that society communicates. You know, it's like, well, I don't know, it's like trying to run a roads policy around the problem of litter.
Yeah, it's definitely a complicated thing. It seems to me that, I know we've kind of covered this already, but it seems to me there are a lot of people, certainly within a lot of the content industries and so on, as you say, that they still haven't quite got to grips with what the internet is and how it works and all that kind of stuff. And something I found interesting recently, this is obviously, I don't want to skew this too much towards music and musicians discussions. I think that kind of betrays my personal interests. I noticed just recently, in fact, that EMI have now been bought out. So we've gone from having four major record labels in the world to three, you know, big major record labels. And it seems that, you know, we'd be better served, certainly speaking from a musician's point of view, by kind of independent labels and doing things directly, as you say, like people like Steve Lawson are doing and Jonathan Colton and people like that. It'd be really good to see kind of a move to those kind of things as well. So I wanted to ask, actually, this is a slightly more kind of philosophical question, but this is one that comes up a lot for me. People say, we've talked about privacy and censorship and so on. And of course, the classic argument you hear from people who are in favor of privacy and censorship is, if you haven't got anything to hide, then it doesn't matter. You know, you don't need privacy because you're not doing anything wrong. You've got nothing to hide. How do you kind of effectively counter that? If you've got any kind of secret nuggets of wisdom, I'd be grateful for them.
Well, I mean, firstly, I think the first question is, if you really have got nothing to hide, then you've probably led a pretty boring life. And the second thing I would say is, you know, of course you have, it depends on the context, I think. But also, I think privacy is, we shouldn't think about this as a sort of absolute question about privacy exactly. It's about controlling information and about the power balance you have with other entities. And, you know, if a company or the government is amassing information on you, then it has the potential to interfere and make decisions about you in a way that may not be in your interest. You know, basically, in a way, this is an argument about transparency, right? You know, does a government want all citizens to be transparent to it, or do we want government to be transparent to us? And which is in our interest? If you want to think about why privacy matters, probably the thing to think about most is your credit record. Now, you're compelled by banks and other people to give that information and share that information, you know, when you've not paid bills, what you've earned, what you've paid back off loans, how well you did with that. They want all that information because they want to make judgments about what they might lend you in the future. Now, whatever the legitimacy of that, they are depriving you of your privacy in order to make very, very important judgments about you in the future. Now, as I understand it, in the States, that can mean that you, for instance, might not get certain jobs, you know, because your credit rating is not considered acceptable for certain sorts of employment. In the UK, that could certainly determine where you live, or perhaps even make you homeless if you're incredibly unlucky. So that shows what information can do to you in a certain situation. If you start applying that to other sorts of situation, your medical history, perhaps, or your ability to therefore get insurance in certain circumstances, then you start to realize that actually your privacy, even around some fairly basic information, might be pretty important to you. And again, you know, you start thinking about how government might misuse that. I mean, so there are some really basic things like, what happens if my internet history gets exposed to the government, or if it's compelled, you know, if in a divorce case that's you know, revealing that is compelled. There's sort of basic things like that where you do see harms you know, from time to time, but they're a little bit exceptional. Then you have the slightly less exceptional but incredibly disturbing things like what happened with ACS Law and where the information they had about alleged downloads of pornography was then sort of spilled out into the internet, and, you know, several thousand people had essentially their sexual preferences or alleged sexual preferences sort of distributed across the net. You know, there are cases like that. And then there's just this simple thing about informational balance. You know, do you really want all this information held by companies and then essentially used against you?
So now, one important question to ask, Jim, is this is Floss Weekly. Yeah. And some of the folk in the IRC chat room have said this is a very unusual Floss Weekly because there have been very few method calls or API invocations discussed this week. Looking at the banner behind you, I see that open source is one of the issues that the Open Rights Group covers. What is your position on open source?
Well, I think it's actually one of the inspirations behind groups like the Open Rights Group. You know, what open source is a demonstration that by sharing information, by collaborating, we can actually do, you know, being open about that information, we can actually be better than some of the sort of closed, entirely proprietary models. So it's an inspiration in information sharing and the power behind it, and a really important counterpoint to some of the controlling instincts of some sort of copyright groups. Beyond that, I think, as I say, there's a basic question and an interest there about the power of information and the ability of people to do more when they control that information. You take privacy, for instance. I mean, if you're worried about privacy, it seems to me that open source technologies and open standards, that sort of combination of factors, is actually really important potentially in protecting your privacy. Or you think of things like free speech and Tor. You know, would it be even realistic to have a project like Tor without open source, you know, without people understanding that. Or again, things like, you know, sort of encryption technologies. Again, if you're not prepared to be open about the sort of encryption tools and standards that you're using and the way that you're doing that, can you really guarantee or make serious judgments about privacy? So for me, there's quite an intense relationship between open source and the ability to see and use information as we like and the rights that we expect in a digital age.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a key thing. And I know you use a lot of open source solutions in you know, the technical to support what you do there. I'm afraid that the clock is ticking and we're going to have to wrap it up, I'm afraid, Jim. But I'm sure we could talk about this for hours. I thought we should kind of finish off by talking about how people can, obviously people based in the UK maybe can get involved and support ORG and all that kind of stuff. So can you give us a bit of that kind of pitch, if you like?
Yeah, absolutely. So please do join. So go to openrightsgroup.org/join. And sign up as a supporter. So you can pay whatever you like, but, you know, a few pounds a month goes a really, really long way to having this office and this team supported and us being able to directly lobby. So please do that. And then secondly, if you're a bit more enthusiastic and you really want to help in a practical way, we also have a technical community that's beginning to sort of run and get involved with these sort of technical activism projects. So people who are interested in open source and building tools or just simply operating things like Tor nodes, get in touch, get onto our email lists and, you know, get really stuck in.
Brilliant. Sounds great. So thank you very much for joining us today. And I'm sure we'll catch up again in the near future. That would be great. And anything else, any other final words you want to leave the listeners and viewers with?
Yeah, we can win this. And it sometimes sounds a bit depressing. And some of the things we've gone through do sound very onerous. And the strength of the lobby against us sometimes is just absurd. But there's one single reason why we can win, which is that the internet and digital technologies is of central importance now to every citizen. And I think huge numbers of people now realize the power that they've been given as a result of digital technologies. You know, social media particularly, I think, has really brought it home to a huge number of people who just did not realize how much power was being given to them through things like the internet. And I think that is a game changer. I don't think politicians have really woken up to exactly how strong that feeling is, the sort of instinct that people have not to be censored and hampered like that. But I think it's an absolute factor now in internet politics, and that's a huge number of people now. So for that reason alone, we can win these battles, and that is exactly why you should join the Open Rights Group.
Excellent, I like it. And I said that would be the end, but I've actually got one final question from the IRC channel. As Simon mentioned, we normally have lots of talk about methods and all that kind of stuff. It's a very technical kind of programmery show. And Randall always asks people if they prefer Vi or Emacs. And people have asked me in the IRC to ask you that. So do you have a preference? I don't know how technical you are on that level.
Well, I've used Vi. I have used Vi. I've done the sort of little bits of tinkering, you know, in my time. So I'm for Vi.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you very much, Jim, for joining us, and we'll speak to you again soon. And keep up the great work with Org.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so that was really fascinating. And as I said, we could have gone on for hours. I know I could anyway. I regularly do. So, Simon, any thoughts on that now that you're an Org board member? How does it feel?
Well, it's been a very interesting day, actually, here at Org HQ, meeting all the people. They've got some very smart, relaxed but passionate people here. And I think that it's good to see them making a difference. You know, it takes a long time to ramp up an organization that really makes a difference in this area. I did public policy work at Sun Microsystems for a long time. And it takes a great deal of time and effort and relationship building to get to a place where you can make a difference and influence society. I think they're doing a great job with their resources. And I hope that we'll get a lot of listeners and viewers in the UK signing up, going to openrightsgroup.org and becoming a supporter. Very worthwhile cause, and I know that it's going to become more and more important to society to have somebody standing up for technology users against the people who are trying to protect their 20th century monopolies against 21st century realities.
Definitely. I couldn't have put it better myself. And I should just mention, I forgot to say, when we were talking about Creative Commons and so on, I know we'll get emails and people will tell me that things like Creative Commons and copyleft rely on the copyright laws. So there's all kinds of levels of complexity there that we need to probably look into. Okay, then. So let's have a quick look at what's coming up, pardon me, on future weeks for Floss Weekly. We've got, next week, Randall will be back with Aaron Newcomb, and they're going to be talking to James Tauber from the Pinax project. This one looks really interesting to me. Pinax is an open source platform for building web applications, and it's built on top of the Django web framework, which I've talked about in the past, and it's a Python web framework. So we look forward to that one. That one's on November 23rd at the regular time. That's not right. It's November 23rd today. I'll get this right in a minute. That's on November 30th. Then on December the 7th, we've got a really interesting show coming up. We've got Monty Verdinus. I can't say his name properly. I apologize for that. And Kurt von Fink, who are from MariaDB, which is something I think Simon knows a little bit about. And Monty was the founder of MySQL, which many of you will know has now been bought up by Oracle. And he's forked the project and started MariaDB. So Randall's going to get an update from them about that. It'll be interesting. And I think Simon is actually on that show as well. So I'm sure
I'll be co-hosting that show with Randall, talking to Monty Verdinus. That's bound to be an interesting show. Monty is never shy about giving his opinions on Oracle and anything else.
Excellent. Sounds good. And then following that, on December the 14th, we've got David Mirat. I'm getting all the names wrong. I'm doing exactly what Randall does. David Mirza, who's from Vega Security Tester. And I've just had a look at that one. It's a tool for testing your web applications, for testing the security of them, things like cross-site scripting, SQL injection, all those kind of things. It will help you to test your web applications and make sure they're secure, which is probably something I should do more of. I think that's probably all. I'll leave that now for the upcoming guests. If you want to get a project onto the list, the best thing to do is have the project leader email Randall, and the address is merlin@stonehenge.com. That's merlin@stonehenge.com. And then Randall can get in touch with them and arrange all that kind of stuff. Okay, then. So let's move on to where you can find me. So if you want to find me, you can find me at danlynch.org, and all of my links and stuff are on there. Simon, what's coming up for you, and where's the best place for people to find you? So I'll do Simon's plug for him. Unfortunately, he seems to have dropped off. So if you want to find Simon, you can go to webmink.com. That's his main website. And you can follow him on Twitter. The name is @webmink, and all kinds of other social networks and so on. So make sure you do that. And I think that's about it for Floss Weekly this week. And unfortunately, Simon's not here. So usually I would say thank you to Simon. Hopefully you'll hear this at some point. Thank you to Simon for joining us. And obviously a big thank you to Jim Killick. And we'll see you next time for another Floss Weekly.